Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting also. We are at santafe.radiocafe.org. That's the website where you can listen to the show any time of day thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Logan Wagner and Ellen Bradbury about Spanish colonial architecture and a little commentary from Ron Bloomberg. That's toward the end of the show. Right now, I'd like to welcome Sherman Alexie. He's an award-winning author of many novels, short stories, poetry, and screenplays, and his latest novel is called Flight. He will be in Santa Fe at Garcia Street Books tonight at 7 o'clock doing a reading and book signing. Welcome, Sherman Alexie, to KSFR.
Oh, thank you.
It's great to have you here. It's an honor to have you here. Flight is an incredible novel. I was hooked from the first line. It's about a 15-year-old boy, orphan boy named Zitz. He is angry, destructive. He's been in 20 different foster homes. And it was so interesting for me reading it because you can see how people saw him from the outside, sullen, angry, destructive teen. We see him in this book from the inside. We see his complexity, his sense of humor, his whole history. What were the sources for this character? Did you draw on your own life?
No, I wasn't a foster kid. My parents were married for 45 years, so I came from a fairly stable background. And because our family was fairly stable, we actually took in foster kids while I was growing up on the reservation and ended up raising a couple cousins as siblings. So I had experience with foster kids that way. And also in Seattle, where I live, I do a lot of work with the homeless and disadvantaged communities. So I end up interacting with a lot of foster kids and adults who used to be foster kids. So that's where my experience with those folks comes from.
The boy commits a horrible crime, and he's shot dead. And then he wakes up in the body of another person in another time. But it's not your standard reincarnation. It's more like stopping for a quick visit. And it was a very interesting technique because it blurs the boundaries between the I, the ego, the person, and the other person whose memories and identity he has a partial knowledge of. Tell us more about that whole device in the novel.
Well, you know, the idea of time traveling as a character I took from Kurt Vonnegut's novel Slaughterhouse-Five,
right,
where his character Billy Pilgrim comes unstuck in time and drops back and forth at various points in his own life. And at first I thought about that, but then I realized that it's going to be really interesting to go back in time to various, you know, archetypal moments in Native American history, to drop this Indian kid into the Battle of Little Bighorn, the massacre at Wounded Knee, the political activism of the 70s. It just seemed very dramatic to do it, and to drop him into bodies, other people, so that he starts developing some sort of empathy, something he doesn't really have. I mean, he really is a borderline, you know, personality, self-involved, narcissistic, and so to have him learn to be educated by dropping him into other people.
And these people are all involved in dramas of, you know, anger and fear and revenge and shame and betrayal. And it was the images that we have of the good guys and the bad guys are really shattered. I mean, I think a lot of people carry around, you know, the evil colonialists and the good indigenous people and so on. There's a lot of wisdom that we get from this book that Zitz learns in the course of the book. And I wondered what the process was like in your own life of coming to that kind of wisdom.
Well, I don't know if it's wisdom, as it says in the book, how do you tell the difference between the good and the bad guys when they say the same things? What really got me thinking about that was 9/11 and the response to it from the left and the right, and the rhetoric was the same. A writer like Ward Churchill, who spoke from the left about the people in the towers deserving their deaths because they were part of the capitalistic machine, and Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell on the right talking about how liberals brought it on the U.S., that, you know, gays and feminists caused this. And there really was no difference in the rhetoric. The far left and the far right sounded exactly the same. And So that idea was in my head when I started writing the novel, there really is no moral difference between the violent rhetoric and violent actions of the left and the same of the right. And so I started looking at Native American and American history with that same sort of sensibility.
There's another 9/11 reference that I guess the title of the book comes from, Flight. One of the characters whose body our main character, Zitz, drops into is a flight instructor who'd had a student who ended up becoming a terrorist.
Yes, that came from, that was really sort of the original seed of the book. I watched a documentary about 9/11, and they interviewed one of the real flight instructors who talked about how the terrorists, the guys he trained, were his friends, they would come to his apartment and they would get drunk and sing songs and tell stories, and sometimes they'd be too drunk to drive home, so they'd sleep on his couch. And he just kept saying they were my friends. And it struck me that nobody had really talked about these terrorists as betrayers of friendships. They really betrayed family and friends in committing that epic crime. So that dichotomy, that small personal betrayal against the backdrop of that epic crime really stunned me and saddened me. And so I wrote a short story that had a fictional flight instructor teaching a fictional terrorist how to fly and the repercussions of that betrayal. After I started writing the novel, I realized that I could drop Zitz into the body of that flight instructor and deal with the most current violent event in American history, in world history.
We're talking to Sherman Alexie, and his new novel is called Flight. There's this amazing moment where he's in the body of, I don't want to give away too much of the book, but he's in the body of a drunken Indian man who's asking a stranger on the street, saying, give me some respect. And when the guy says, well, what kind of respect do you want? He says, tell me a story. And that, it was unexpected, but it rang true and on some deep level. And I wondered, what is for you, as a storyteller, the connection between respect and storytelling?
You know, it's interesting because that's in the book and it has all sorts of meaning, I suppose, but it does really come from a real event.
Really?
I was in Tucson, Arizona, 6-7 years ago, and I was staying in a downtown hotel, and there was a homeless man below the window. I was on the fifth floor or so, screaming for an hour, I want some respect, I want some respect, and couldn't sleep. It was going on, and I couldn't, you know. And I didn't want to call the cops because I didn't want this guy to get harassed. And I'm sure it must have been the same for all the other patrons who were either really heavy sleepers or who didn't care or whatever. And then finally, after about an hour of this, somebody threw open their window, leaned out from the hotel, and said, all right, I respect you. You know, now get the hell out of here. And there's a long pause. Silence, and then the homeless guy said, thank you, and then it was over.
Wow.
And I realized, you know, that was pretty simple thing to do. You know, if somebody, me, had leaned out the window 47 minutes ago, you know, I'd be asleep by now.
Right.
So I'd always thought about that moment and how simple it was to please somebody, to show respect. And so in writing that into a fictional version, I just started thinking, what's the simplest way to respect somebody? It's to talk to them. And then when he asks for a story, a personal story, a secret, that really is a level of intimacy that does show lots of respect. So it's not just about story. It's about sharing a piece of your life.
I wondered why the main character drops back into the bodies of only men and not women. I mean, he goes into quite a range of men, you know, white and native and all sorts of walks of life, but not women.
It never even occurred to me. I don't even know why. It's because I'm a man. Somebody had asked me in an interview earlier in the tour about Quantum Leap, the TV series from the early 90s, where the guy did drop into bodies throughout time. And dropped into women quite a bit. I just started laughing. I thought it never even occurred to me. I missed out on so many dramatic possibilities. So I screwed up. Because the hilarity involved. I mean, it's a very serious book, but it's also, this is a very funny guy. So, you know, What's the first thing a 15-year-old would do if he was dropped into the body of an adult woman? So,
the first thing he would do?
Oh, masturbate like crazy, I'm sure.
Heavens.
Yes. So, but then, you know, after that initial rush, that initial emotion and arousal, he would be met with an entirely foreign existence. So, so I really, really screwed up by not having him drop into the body of a woman.
That's funny. I thought it was more that this is about a whole set of masculine themes like war and revenge and stuff like that, and his education comes through seeing those things always from a masculine perspective.
But those are also feminine themes. So especially now, when you think about the number of women that are serving in the U.S. military, who are dying in this war in numbers unlike any other point in American history. So women's relationship with war and violence is every bit as interesting and intense as males. So, I really missed out. Even in the book, there's a point at which 8-year-old girls are participating in horrible atrocities during battles. So, you know, I certainly don't take the position that women are somehow separate from war.
Right, right. I have to say, when I find myself reading a really good novel like this one, I sometimes believe there has to be reincarnation, because otherwise how could an author know people so unlike himself or herself so authentically? How do you experience that? How do you do that? How do you get inside the characters, the heads of characters of people who are so essentially different from you?
Oh, they're all me.
You think you really tap into the common shared thread with everybody?
I don't think people are all that much different, essentially. So I think what you end up tapping into is sort of the essentialness of people and just getting sort of glimpses of eccentricity. And it's those glimpses of eccentricity that really make well-rounded characters. And by and large, most of those eccentricities are mine in some degree or another, or my friends or family. I just borrow little bits of people all around me. And that's what I think really makes the character seem realistic.
We're talking to Sherman Alexie, and the novel is called Flight. He will be at Santa Fe at Garcia Street Books tonight at 7 o'clock, doing a reading and book signing. I read the book from cover to cover in two sittings. When I was reading it, I felt like time stopped. I couldn't even answer the phone. It was so good, so gripping. And I have to say, I read tons of books, and this is a very rare thing, which is a perfect book. It's flawless. How did you know when it was done?
When my publisher said, get that book in here, or we're going to miss the publication deadline.
No, really?
Yeah, no, it was really a very practical matter of, you know, the book has to come in today, or we're going to miss our publication deadline. So I'd still be working on it.
Really? Yeah. Are there things, when you look back, I don't know if you've reread it since it came out in print, but are there things you would change?
Yeah, I would drop him into a body of a woman. There's a number, of course, always rewriting. I would have expanded some sections. I would have, there's, you know, the bank shootout. I would have expanded that. I would have just spent a little more time. Well, one of the things is that he develops more of an empathy for other people. I would have developed that process more for him, that as the book went on, he would have gotten further and further into the people around him's heads. Not the people he dropped into, but the people around the people he dropped into, showing more and more empathy and getting farther into thinking about them and caring about them. So, yeah, there's always stuff to be improved.
Oh, that's so interesting, because I figured it was the way it was because this is a 15-year-old boy, and 15-year-old boys, for all of their vulnerability and beauty, really don't have that much empathy, so the extent to which he developed it seems very realistic and natural.
Yeah, I think so, but he was dropping into the body of adults, so he would have been picking up on their sensibilities as well, and I don't think I took that far enough.
Very interesting. Now, who are some of the authors from whom you drew inspiration? You talked about Slaughterhouse-Five. The first line seems to be a reference to Moby Dick. Who are some of your inspirations?
Well, for this book, Moby Dick, I mean, the first line is Call Me Zitz, which echoes Call Me Ishmael.
Right.
And I intended that to be funny, which it is, but also to point out the epic nature of a teenager's complexion to his life.
Right.
So, but for this book, it was you know, science fiction genre, you know, it was Slaughterhouse-Five, it was Moby Dick, it was sort of American history in the sense of violence, so there was a lot of thought about various genre novels. You know, Catcher in the Rye, certainly that Rye sense of teenage angst and cynicism was part of it. So just a few ideas like that.
I suppose you could categorize it as sci-fi genre, but it doesn't really read that way. Did you intend it to be like a sci-fi?
Well, it has sci-fi elements. It's not a sci-fi novel, primarily because you know, I don't really get into the machine of how the time travel works, the process by which it works, because, frankly, it may not be happening. This is a borderline personality kid, so he is a highly unreliable narrator. So we don't necessarily know that this time travel stuff is happening. So I wanted to preserve that sense of mystery, so I think that's part of the literary. It's a literary novel, not a sci-fi novel because of that.
Yeah, I actually wondered as I was reading it whether the whole thing was somehow a dream that happened in the second between when he was shot and when he fell to the floor.
That could very well be the case. I intentionally left that sort of open, and I think I didn't leave it quite open enough to make people think that this may not have happened.
We're talking to Sherman Alexie. Now, you are somebody who works in many areas. You've made films. You've been a stand-up comic on top of everything else. What are you working on now?
Well, this fall, my young adult novel called The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian is being published. It's in September by Little Brown. I have a family memoir I'm working on that'll be out next year sometime. A new book of poems is coming out next year called Thrash. And I continue to lecture and perform around the country on stage. So, always busy.
Excuse the perhaps dumb question, but what is a young adult novel? What's the difference between that and a novel?
A young adult novel is written for and geared toward teenagers.
And so, and it's not geared toward adults? I mean, if an adult read it, they would think, this is a kid's, you know, young person.
Oh, no, not at all. So it's just, you know, that's one of the misperceptions about young adult literature. I actually think, you know, in the last 5 years when I really started reading young adult literature as I was thinking about writing a book, I think young adult novels are far better than their adult counterparts in the last 5 years. So it really is just books that focus on the life experiences of teenagers, and that adults are always very secondary. So that's the primary difference, not the writing quality or the writing style, but the focus.
Would you like to read a little passage from Flight?
I don't have a book with me.
Oh, okay then. Well, then people will have to come to Garcia Street Books tonight at 7 o'clock, which is when you'll be there. I wondered, if you come in contact a lot with Indian teenagers, and what advice you have for them in their process of trying to find their identity, which, I mean, you know, just living in Santa Fe, that's a difficult process for a lot of young Indian kids.
Santa Fe is difficult for any Indian.
Yeah.
You walk into Santa Fe and you feel like somebody's going to hand you $5 and jump on your back.
Heavens.
So, you know, for teenage kids in Santa Fe, my advice would be to get the hell out as soon as you can. You know, get yourself into a place where, I mean, because it's just as dangerous to be objectified for positive reasons as it is for negative reasons. And I think all that pressure, all that art, all that romance around Indians in Santa Fe is just really scary for an Indian kid who's struggling, or any Indian kid who's not struggling. Get nomadic. That's always my advice to Indian teenagers, to any teenager, to any human being. Get nomadic and kinetic. Travel. Get out. Go see the world.
What do you mean by objectified for positive reasons?
Well, all those beautiful images of natives and our spirituality and our art and our religions and our faces. Everywhere in Santa Fe are all these incredible, beautiful representations of us. And only in a few galleries, only in a few places in Santa Fe is the art expressly political about the difficulty of being Indian when, by and large, a lot of the art, a lot of the imagery is sort of this, you know, ethereal representations. It doesn't really have a lot to do with our contemporary lives and the magic and loss of a contemporary life. So in a lot of ways, we're frozen in time in Santa Fe. And so that really doesn't do anything for us. It exists for the benefit of non-Indians. And so Santa Fe can at times seem like a living representation of the difficulties we face, like a community as metaphor for what Indians have to deal with in society in general, the feeling that we, by and large, most people see us as frozen in time.
It's interesting. My dear friend is an Inca from the highlands of Peru, and he was here for some years, and got very depressed in Santa Fe because he realized that he could make a fortune doing fake Inca ceremonies for divorced ladies from Santa Fe who were looking for an Indian guru.
There are plenty of people doing that there.
And he went back to Peru, but we would read the paper, and there would be a picture of a quote-unquote Inca shaman, and he would look at the guy's picture and say, I know that guy. He's a musician. He's not a shaman. He plays the panpipes in a band.
Well, the thing is, there are plenty of white folks, a lot of white liberals especially, who are far more lost than any Native American and who, you know, have all sorts of privilege and comfort, and with that privilege and comfort comes a lot of time to sit alone and think, and that's always dangerous. And that loneliness rushes in, and lonely people are easily manipulated.
There's one thing I wanted to ask you about. You talked before about the main character, Zitz, going through some of the major points of Native American history in the book. And there's one point early on where he is in Idaho during a scene where the FBI is confronting some Indians on the reservation, and he sees these, he doesn't quite realize that he's not himself and not his own body anymore, and he sees these two Native American heroes, and they turn out to be FBI informers, they turn out to be double agents. Now, do you know something we don't know, or is this your fantasy? Did these people exist? What was going on there?
Many of us in the Indian community and in the non-Indian community that's very close to us know that during the political activism of the late 60s, early 70s, among the American Indian movement and other Native American activists, there were a lot of double agents. There were a lot of informants. The FBI turned a lot of Native Americans, and there are a couple of them who are relatively famous. In the Indian world, there are a couple who make livings off being famous former political activists who worked with the FBI. So, yes, I know things you don't know.
I don't want to give away too much of the book, and I would also like to say that we talk about books a lot on this program, and there's a lot of people who get the content and then feel that they don't need to read the book. But this is a book, ladies and gentlemen, that you actually need to read, because we can't possibly do it justice by talking about it on the air. So the book is called Flight. It's by Sherman Alexie. And I want to thank you so much for being with us and for doing the wonderful work you do.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking to Sherman Alexie. He's the award-winning author of many novels, short stories, lots of poetry, screenplays. He's a filmmaker, and the latest novel is called Flight. He'll be in Santa Fe at Garcia Street Books tonight at 7 o'clock. He'll be doing a reading and book signing. And that's it. We're going to hear a commentary right now from Ron Blumberg. Stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Blumberg, just a voice in the crowd. You know what's missing from your life? A good song. Think about it. What song are you whistling these days? There's nothing to whistle. I watched the Tonys a couple of weeks ago. The only memorable songs were the songs from revivals. The great Broadway musicals used to give us romance, wit, melodic songs that you couldn't get out of your head. Then along came Andrew Lloyd Webber, and you walked out whistling The Set, The Chandelier. Rodgers and Hart gave us Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered. Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice gave us songs from Cats. If you put me in a flat, then I'd rather have a house. If you set me on a mouse, then I only want a rat. If you set me on a rat, then I'd rather chase a mouse. Try singing that to the love of your life. All right, I'll brighten your life. You won't get this song out of your head. You'll be whistling this one all day long.
Your Majesty.
No, no, not the way I see Europeans dance tonight.
It was just like that.
Was not holding hands like this.
No, as a matter of fact.
Was. Like this. No?
Yes.
Come!
Etc., etc., etc. Talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
You can hear Ron every Tuesday on the Radio Cafe, on Thursdays after the noon news, and Saturdays following Bob Edwards.
I'd like now to welcome Logan Wagner. He is an expert on Spanish colonial architecture and will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Tipton Hall. And we're also joined by Ellen Bradbury, who is co-author with Dr. Wagner of the book Contemporary Mexican Design and Architecture, and she's the director of Recursos. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Hi, it's great to have you. Now, the talk tonight is an introduction to the architecture of Mexico in preparation for a tour of the Yucatan. Why the Yucatan?
Well, the Yucatan is a unique area of the world. It's part of Mexico, but at the same time, it's very different to Mexico. Its history, its terrain, its culture, and interestingly enough, it has several similarities with how New Mexico developed at this same time.
For example?
For example, Yucatan and New Mexico were at the extremes of New Spain. So they were some of the later part of New Spain that was colonized. And because of their remoteness, and because of the lack of minerals and other type of wealth that the early conquistadores and colonizers were looking for, they were left to be colonized later. So that's something that New Mexico and Yucatan have similar histories about.
Now, tell us about the architecture of conversion. What's the relationship between architecture and the conversion of indigenous people to Catholicism?
Okay. The conquest of Mexico, after Hernán Cortés conquered Tenochtitlan, the Aztec capital, it was more of a spiritual conquest than a military conquest. And in so being, the early friars, mostly Franciscans, but there were three mendicant friar orders that were entrusted by the King of Spain to convert the native population. And they did this by learning their rituals, by building their churches in their sacred places and incorporating their rituals into the Catholic ritual system. And the buildings, which had a very strict format in Spain, actually began changing and creating new forms of architecture that would encourage the conversion, make it easy for the native population to come into the Christian fold.
What were some of those characteristics of the new architecture?
Well, the most important one, and that's what I'm going to focus principally tonight in the lecture, is the use of open space. The native cultures were accustomed to having their rituals outdoors, in nature, in coordination with the natural environment, with the celestial elements, and so they were used to having their rituals outdoors, and the friars in this early period continued this tradition by creating these churchyards in front of the church. Back then they were called patios or corrales. Art historians have come up with a new term, and they call them atrios. And there's elements in the atrio that you don't see in Spain, you don't see in Europe, and they were born here as a way of facilitating the conversion process.
I always have to note the oxymoron involved in the idea of conversion to Catholicism, given that the word Catholic means universal. But that aside, this is a classic example of co-opting a religion, co-opting a people, bringing them in through conversion rather than force. But what happened when they didn't want to? Was there force?
Very little force. Very few examples of documented force. There are examples of, for instance, Diego de Landa, the Franciscan friar in Yucatan, who was very controversial because, for one, he burned all the sacred books in the site of Mani,
which is a church in Mani. We'll go to Mani and see where he burned all the great codices. Huge loss.
Which was a huge loss to historians that came by later to have lost all those books. So in that sense, there was forced conversion, and there's chronicles of how friars would punish natives because they were still following their rituals or venerating their gods, and they'd have to do it in hidden circumstances, go into hidden caves to continue their rituals. But it wasn't a military conquest. It was a spiritual conquest, and you have to give it to the friars that they got in and learned about these cultures, native cultures, and then found ways. They were very resourceful. They found ways of finding the similarities between the rituals of the natives and the Catholic rituals.
And they have the four directions and up and down, so it's really six directions. And in these atrios, at each corner, which is a different direction, there's a place to stop and pray. And then, and you see these in New Mexico, in front of every church in the pueblos, and many churches, there's a sort of squared off defined space, and that is the sacred space. And that's what they invent in Mexico. So it comes right up here. And we have it in the pueblos and in the great old churches of Pecos and Abo and Quaray and, you know, those churches. So it's, you look at it there, you see it here. Oh, but anyway.
One of the new breakthroughs in learning about native cultures, ancient native cultures, that has been accomplished through archaeology and epigraphy. Epigraphy is the reading and deciphering of ancient writing. In this case, Maya hieroglyphic writing. One of the things that has been discovered is this ever-present concept of what art historians are now calling the quinquex. Quinquex, which means that this primordial concept that the world is divided into four corners, and that's a terrestrial plane where we humans live in, and that's the real life. But in the center of this quadrilateral is an axis mundi that connects to the supernatural world in the underworld and in the skies. And that quincunx concept, which you see it from the Olmecs all the way to the Aztecs, is continued after the conquest in the churches as a way to bring the native population to be around the church and to continue those rituals. And the axis mundi becomes a Christian cross, which wasn't an unknown symbol to the pre-Columbian peoples as well. It's the world tree. So all these coincidences from Europe, from Spanish European ritual and the Native American ritual are coming together in the 16th century, and they produce these new forms of architecture. And it's a very fascinating period of history when these two so different worlds clash, but they clash and meld together and come up with a new form of art.
Now, do elements of the native religion survive to this day in the way Catholicism is practiced in Mexico?
In native indigenous areas, yes, definitely.
And do you feel that the essence of the native religion survives, or just little elements of it thrown in?
It does. It does survive, and you can feel it when you go to the church in Chichicastenango, Guatemala, for instance, where there's no pews and there's candles and incense. And it's not like going to an ordinary church. It is a church building, but something different is going on. And historians call it Christian paganism. And you see that all through Latin America, indigenous Latin America.
And in New Mexico, too, we have a lot of that. And, I mean, it was one of the ideas when I thought of doing a tour to see the churches in Yucatan. I thought the similarities, both in the way that Catholicism has sort of moved into the pueblos but sits a little on the outside, but they go to the dances. And in Mexico, too, you have this curious accommodation that is still going on. So we have it in Mexico, we have it here.
We're talking to Logan Wagner and Ellen Bradbury, and Dr. Wagner will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Tipton Hall about this very subject, Mexican architecture. What building, I mean, Spanish colonial architecture, I guess you'd call it, but I wanted to ask you, what building techniques did the conquerors, did the clergy bring from Spain, and what did they learn from the people whose land they were now on, from the indigenous people? How did those merge into the architecture that you have now?
Okay, you're referring to construction techniques? Construction techniques. Okay, the Spanish had very developed building systems as far as working with stone, working with adobe, working with wood. But lo and behold, the native cultures of Mesoamerica were also very developed, especially with stone, building with stone. They had cement. Europe gets cement from the Romans, discovered how to make cement. Well, lo and behold, the Maya were using cement. And you get cement by burning limestone and mixing it with sand, and that's how you get cement. Well, lo and behold, we have that here in the Americas. So. And there's other little techniques that you see in these early 16th century buildings where you see a combination of European and Native American techniques. The way the stone is carved, techniques like chinking, putting little stones in the mortar between the ashlar stone. That's a Native American building technique that the Spanish saw the value of it and continued using it, and many buildings in Mexico today are still using that system.
So you're also involved in architectural restoration.
Yes, I'm an architect. I have a firm based in Austin, Texas. We do new builds and we do restoration, but even the new buildings, what we specialize in is using old primitive techniques and natural building materials.
So when you go to restore a building in Mexico or in New Mexico, let's say, a colonial church, what are some of the problems that the restorers face? I mean, do you feel that you always have to work with the authentic materials? Do you bring in modern techniques?
Each case is different. Each case is different. But generally speaking, as a philosophy, you want to build with the same materials, rebuild with the same materials, and the same techniques. It takes much longer, and it's all hand tools that you're using. It takes much longer, and that's why restoration is an expensive proposition, because it takes so much longer to build. But luckily, there's still craftsmen out there that have learned these techniques through generations, and they're still alive, and that's the beauty of countries like Mexico, that you can still find these age-old building techniques using natural materials. And I think and I hope that there'll be a comeback to it, because instead of manufacturing materials somewhere else and transporting them and all the energy and fuel that it takes to produce a modern house, that you could just use the materials around you, which is what the settlers did, is what the natives did. You always use the materials that are around you.
Which is what everybody did until fossil fuels.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing I wanted, Logan, to talk about a little is the size of these churches. They are enormous churches. And they're really not even just the churches come last. So.
Yeah, well, usually the process is, first of all, the Spanish crown would send the friars, the mendicant friars, to the native population centers, and only they could go in there. They were the ones that were entrusted in converting them into the Spanish Christian fold. The Spanish civil population, they formed their own cities. For instance, Puebla, Oaxaca, Guadalajara, those are Spanish cities built for the Spanish, as opposed to the existing communities where the friars were the only ones allowed there. And
let me just stick in one thing, and that is why in New Mexico we have two Tasukis, two Nambes, because the Spanish could not live in the Indian communities by law. So.
Yes.
And why was that?
Because the Spanish philosophy of conquering new lands, their battle flag was to convert the native population, not to exterminate, but to convert it. Okay, so it was the friars that went in there. Their mission, and that's why they're missionaries, was to convert the native population. And the first thing they soon realized that if they built the church somewhere else, nobody was going to go. But if they built their church in the ceremonial center, it was a continuation of those rituals. And the first process was to build an open chapel in a place for the missionary to stay. And usually it was one or two people. That's it.
Who had better have some serious building and architectural training.
Yes. And sometimes they would bring craftsmen with them, but a lot of the times it was just the friar who remembered what the church looked like back in Spain and used that as a model. But what really worked in the Spanish friars' favor was that the native population was accustomed to paying tribute to their gods by donating their labor to build the ceremonial centers. So they continued that tradition, and that's why you see these fabulous churches in the middle of nowhere, you know, that are comparable to the Gothic cathedrals in Europe.
And you are going to take people on a tour to visit some of these places.
Yeah, that's the idea I had, that for Cornerstones and for the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art, to see these churches as well as stay in these fabulous abandoned and then redone haciendas that are all over, well, not all over, but in Mexico. It's amazing when you see these churches. And the tie to New Mexico is really, I mean, they're both Franciscans. The other thing about the open chapels is I think the first open chapels look like band shells. They look like what you have in Central Park. They're kind of acoustic devices that with a little elevation so the priest can stand up there and talk.
Without a microphone.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
One thing to keep in mind is this... this coincidence that is going on between the native mind and the Spanish mind of the friars. But in the Mesoamerican worldview, they have these portals, these natural portals that you go through and you can communicate with the supernatural world. And those portals are usually openings in the earth crust, like caves, like crevices. And imagine these open chapels. The shell looks like the opening of a cave. Okay? So the friar is in the opening of the cave. He is in communication with the supernaturals. This is the mindset of the native population. That fire, just like their rulers that were put in place to rule them, they were the rulers because they had that ability to communicate with the gods. And they communicated through these portals.
And so the friars weren't really communicating through these portals, but they were pretending they were. It was the image.
The image of in the native mindset, this guy's at the mouth of the cave.
Right.
And you see that in Mesoamerican art throughout. The cave, the quatrefoil, all these portals are these sacred openings to the supernatural world.
So it's really, I mean, in a way, it's an education in how to control people.
Well, it.
Get in their mindset and copy what their rulers do.
Yeah, and in pre-Columbian times, it was this religious, political mindset that was instituted from the earliest pre-classic cultures all the way to the post-classic, to the Aztecs, who were latecomers on the Mesoamerican scene, and then continued, thanks to the friars, into the colonial period.
We only have about a minute left, but you are both co-authors of a book called Contemporary Mexican Design and Architecture. The roots of contemporary architecture are to be found in some of these churches that you're talking about?
They are. There's elements, there's the use of open space, the color that is characteristic in modern Mexican architecture that is manifested. You know, it has its roots way in the past, but even in modern architecture you're seeing examples of it, and that's what our book talks about.
And if I can say, if people would be interested in this tour, which is in December, they could call 982-9301 and we'll get back to you, because it's a tour that goes December 3rd through 10th, and we'll visit as many of these places as we can.
So a week in Mexico in December, ladies and gentlemen, 982-9301. I want to thank you both so much for being here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Logan Wagner is an expert on Spanish colonial architecture. Ellen Bradbury is the director of Recursos. They are co-authors of a book called Contemporary Mexican Design and Architecture. And Logan Wagner will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock in a lecture at Tipton Hall. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams on the web at ksfr.org, and we are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz presents the monthly New Orleans Hour. And then Giants of Jazz, after the at-noon news, features the fifth installment of the Duke Ellington tribute, including a complete performance of the Far East Suite. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.